Now, in connection with this, since I've been talking about Orient and Occident, let me very briefly summarize first the Oriental and then a very handsome Occidental view of the four stages of life. To begin with, let me describe the Indian view. The main principle in India is that in the middle of life, there's to be a radical change and division that is provided for by the society and by the patterns of the society. The first half of life is to be lived in the village, in society, performing the duties of one's caste. The second half of life is to be lived in the forest, performing yoga. Casting off the duties of life, casting off the aims of life in society, and devoting oneself through totally different life circumstances, totally different life disciplines, to the ultimate task, which is a different ultimate task from ours, by the way. Now, each of these two stages of life is divided in half. The first half of each being devoted to learning, to the disciplines of preparation, and the second half to fulfillment. Now, the Orthodox age dates are 15 years. This is 15 years, 30 years, 45, and out. The Indians had a shorter lifespan to look forward to normally than we have. The first stage is that of the student. The student is to be chaste, is to devote all of his attention and energy to the guru, the teacher. The word guru means something very different from what teacher means in our culture. The guru is not only a communicator of information and teacher of disciplines, he is a model for life. He is a moral model. The student is to try to imitate him, to identify with him, to be as the guru is. The student then submits himself completely to his guru. Then at the age of 15 or so comes the stage known as the householder stage, grihastha, the one standing in the house. The marriage is consummated. Now, here, these two people have never seen each other before. There's been nothing like what our young people have, this problem of what am I going to be, what are my values, what do I think of that, what is my idea of a wife or a husband. No, the family makes the arrangement. They've never seen each other before. It doesn't matter. Now, the first duty of the household is to produce children. This is in honor of the ancestral cult. And so, by the time the father reaches middle age, 30-ish or so, there is a son in the house eligible to take over the duties of his dharma. He gives over his dharma, his virtue, his duty to his son in a beautiful rite. All of the rites, by the way, are beautiful. Marriage rites, transferring of duty rites. What one does is identify oneself with the cosmic principle of which one is but the microcosmic manifestation. And so you're living, as it were, as a vehicle of cosmic power. Well, now comes the time of going to the forest. Woman may go to the forest. The father properly should go to the forest. I've asked Indian women, what do you have to look forward to? In your childhood, you're obeying your parents. In your maturity, you're obeying your husband. If your husband dies and you don't throw yourself on the funeral pyre, you're obeying your oldest son. What do you have to look forward to? They've all answered. I've asked four of them this. We look forward to becoming mothers-in-law. When the daughter-in-law is brought into the house, there's somebody we can boss around. This will give you a sense of the flavor, and who would give that up for the forest? So the father goes off alone. Furthermore, it is said in many texts that women are not particularly endowed for yoga. They have too much life in their bodies. Yoga is a masculine madness. It is an attempt to cut out the last vestige of a desire or feeling for life at all, just to cut it. The extreme aims of yoga are hardly realized by people who, in a dilettante way, go in for this business. Just think of it. Throughout life, you have obeyed your duties according to your caste. That is what you have devoted yourself to. You have not asked, would I like to do this? Would I like to do that? You have done your duty. That means there has been no development of ego. There has been a squelching of ego all along. Then you go to the forest. You have a very light ego to crack, so to say. What has to be done there? You might recall that moment was lovely. This moment I did not like. You're now to erase all sense of difference between what was nice and what was not nice, what is painful and what is pleasurable. That's why these mad ordeals, so that you would become used to pain, so that you become used to agony, so that it wouldn't make any difference to you, so that your life milieu would be agony. And so then, what of pleasure? What that would be simply a loss of the thing you've now got used to, namely pain, the indifference, and finally the breaking, so to say, of the very grabbing of the cells to life, and you dissolve. The third stage, then, the first in the forest, is that of learning to break the hold on life. And the fourth stage is that of the one who has broken it. He is what is called released. Shankaracharya, the great saint of the 9th century, declares that a man who is released is like a burnt string. That looks like a string, but if you blow on it, there's nothing there. These saints wandering around look like human beings, but there's nobody there. There's no sense of an individual in that body. When he goes into the forest, he gives up his virtue. He gives up his dharma. He gives up his family and everything. And now he's going to just wait for the body, as they say, to drop off. This is the basic Oriental idea.